Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we will be talking about suicide prevention on college campuses. And it turns out that suicide is the second leading cause of death among college students. Now, it's also true that the number of college students that might commit suicide on any particular campus in any particular year is small. Fortunately, is small. However, the numbers do add up if you look at college campuses across the country, and it is something that administrators and counselors on college campuses all across the United States are very concerned about. It turns out that the University of Illinois has really been a pioneer in the area of suicide prevention. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what is happening here on this campus and also trying to look in a little bit larger way at how colleges are dealing with this particular issue. And our guest for the show is Dr. Paul Joffe. He's a clinical psychologist. He works at the University of Illinois Counseling Center. And for the past 20 years, he has been the chief of the suicide prevention team here at the University of Illinois. This policy was instituted in the mid-1980s, and have been the folks here at the university who really can point to this program as a success, with a significant reduction in the number of suicides if you compare the period after the program started with the period before. So as we talk this morning, certainly questions and comments are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of listeners is that people, when they call in, are as brief as they can be. And we really just ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and so that we can get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number for people who are listening here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and so if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I appreciate it. Maybe if we can just start just for a second to talk about some numbers. I have now seen, and I hope that it is indeed correct in several places, this statistic that suicide is the second leading cause of death among college students. Do you think that that's actually the case?
Yes, it is the case, and okay, as data collected by the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Okay. In any given year, what number are we talking about if you look at all across the country, colleges and universities?
It's estimated there's not hard data on the number of students who commit suicide. Individual campuses may have the hard data, so it's extrapolated to be about 1,100 students over the last year.
Okay. And something else that I think that it is also true, though, that if you compare college students with non-students of the same age group, that in fact, generally speaking, the risk of suicide among college students is actually less than non-students in that same age cohort. Is that right?
Yeah, actually the landmark study for this issue was actually partly started by the University of Illinois in the early 1980s and then taken up by the Big Ten universities, and it established that the rate for university students was pretty much exactly half of what it was for their non-attending peers.
Hmm. Well, maybe we can at some point we get into talking about what it is we think we know about suicide and particular things about this particular population, this particular group of people, and what may make them like others or not. But maybe here it would be good right at the beginning to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the suicide prevention program here at the University of Illinois and what exactly it involves.
The beginning of the program probably stretches back all the way 30 years ago when the then Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs, Stan Levy, instituted a policy that kind of created a clearinghouse in which university personnel, if they were aware that a student attempted threat and suicide, were asked to fill out a report and submit it to the counseling center. When I joined the staff of the counseling center about 7 years later, there hadn't really been much of a developed response of what we should do with this data once we received it. And the first thing that I did is I started working with the coroner's office to create a kind of a study or a sample so we could better understand what the nature of the problem was on campus. And they provided us with 19 profiles, what they call psychoautopsies, of students who had committed suicide over the previous 8-year period. And that told us some very interesting things. First, the majority of people we could kind of predict would be commit suicide because they had made prior attempts. Then we also were quite interested in the mental health pattern usage prior to their death, and found that while the majority had mental health contact, about 67%, only one of the 19 students had actually met with a social worker or a psychologist in the year before they died. And, you know, suicide was supposed to be a cry for help, so this was a bit of a surprise about why kind of intervention that we would have thought would have been helpful for these students wasn't being sort of offered or received, or we weren't kind of connecting with these students. So we spent the data basically said that there were essentially two students would be dying on our campus on an average year, and one of those students would commit suicide out of the blue without any kind of prior indication, and the other student would commit suicide after sort of a lengthy public career in which they may have attempted or threatened before in the months, weeks, years before they died. And when we looked at that, we thought, well, maybe we don't know how to stop the student who's committing suicide out of the blue, but maybe we have an opportunity here to intervene with a student who is giving us some public indication that they're suicidal. So that's what we started to do. And we started by kind of a voluntary program in which we sort of invited and encouraged any student who had made an attempt or threat to come meet with a counselor and talk with us. And we thought maybe four times to kind of get at the roots of what was going on, why they thought that was a reasonable option for them, what other options they might have. And we found that we couldn't get these students to come see us. We would call, we would write, we'd have friends kind of call and meet with them saying, you know, you just attempted suicide over the weekend. Wouldn't it be a good idea to talk to a professional about it? And they would say, you know, I don't have a problem. I'm all better now. You know, I'm busy with finals or busy with my exams. You know, I'll get back to you. And they wouldn't. We found probably only 5% of the students that we tried to invite and encourage into some sort of counselor would actually come in. So we were left with a kind of a moral dilemma here, because we knew that while the majority of people who made attempts and threats weren't going to go on to commit suicide, they would sort of retire from that career before a lethal conclusion, that a small percentage would. But they also wouldn't get help along the way, and we would be sort of these sort of knowledgeable bystanders watching the process but not having much not much opportunity to intervene. So in the fall semester of 1984, we did what was sort of novel in the country at that point. We thought we had a duty to intervene that overrode their right to privacy or non-interference. And we pretty much mandated a standard that after any attempt or threat, a student needed to receive four sessions of professional assessment, or they actually ran the risk of being withdrawn from the university. Now, we've been doing that program for now 20 years. The rate of suicide has essentially dropped in half, and we've actually been more effective than we could have imagined. We've not had a student commit suicide in the last 20 years in which we had a prior knowledge or a report that they were suicidal in terms of a threat or attempt. And actually, all the suicides that have occurred, and they still occur, a little over one a year, are these out-of-the-blue types in which there's no prior indication. Mm. Now, at the same time, just as a cautionary note, we've not had to withdraw students from school. We did withdraw one student for 3 months. She re-enrolled and subsequently graduated. So we could argue that the program has been effective.
Just very quickly, let me reintroduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're talking with Paul Joffe. He's a clinical psychologist. He works at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and for the past 20 years, he's been chair of the suicide prevention team. And that's what we're talking about here in this first hour of the show, that is suicide prevention on college campuses. And as I mentioned at the beginning, the University of Illinois has really been a pioneer in this area. Now, as Dr. Joffe mentioned, back in the mid-80s, instituting this prevention policy that, among other things, perhaps the central feature is that someone who has attempted suicide or seems to be a likely candidate is required by the university to go into counseling, at least to have these four formal kind of sessions with a counselor, and that it seems that it has really been effective, and a lot of other campuses have looked at what's happened at the university to try to decide what it is they want to do on their campuses. So questions here again, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I would imagine that if you talked about the fact that initially you encountered a lot of resistance. If you had a student who attempted suicide and you said to that student, you know, we have this counseling center here, we have this resource, don't you think it would be a good idea to come in and see someone, that a lot of students, you got stonewalled. They said, no, it's okay, I don't need that help. Or they would make the appointment, but they would never show up. So then you decided, well, the thing to do was you felt the responsibility was that you would require them to do it. I would guess, though, that if you have people that are initially reluctant to come in voluntarily, even if you require them to come in, are they going to – what are they going to say when they get there? Are they going to say the same things? Are they going to say, well, I really don't have any problem, I'm feeling better now, I was dealing with a lot of pressure, but it's okay. And that is that you still – that the counselors that meet with the students still have a challenge in getting the student to participate in the process.
I would say about 10% sort of fit the profile of stonewalling the mm-hmm. counselor, maybe 5 to 10% in which there's really not very – they're not forthcoming with any more information. But the vast majority of students, once they are there – are willing to kind of talk, are willing to build a relationship with the therapist, are willing to kind of dig in and explore, you know, the factors leading, you know, to their attempt and threat. Hmm.
Then how many of these students then go on to have some kind of longer-term counseling past the mandated 4 times?
You know, we offer that uniformly. We don't have hard statistics, but I'd sort of guess between 10 and 20% will go beyond that and attend additional sessions.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that actually the risk of suicide in college students tends to be less than if you look at young people their age who are not students. If you look at those people who are college students who do attempt suicide, do you think that there is something about this particular group that is somehow different from teenagers who attempt suicide, or adults who attempt suicide, or, you know, the risk of suicide is quite high among seniors. If you look at different groups of people according to their background and their age, is there anything about the college student that makes him or her different?
You know, I'm not fully an expert in because suicide does really break down into specific sort of age and other sort of population characteristics. So I'm aware of some of the research, but I'm not really directly immersed. I think one thing that's different for college students is that there's a different opportunity because there is a sort of a communal living situation, because there's a lot of communication amongst college students, that one college student is much more likely, particularly undergraduates, not so much true for graduate students, but undergraduates are much more likely to communicate their feelings and intent than I think that you'll see in older populations that are in the workforce.
Yeah. Does that – well, I guess then that raises another question about – what you do, in what way you educate all students so that if their roommate or a friend is talking about suicide, that I guess the question would be what do you tell them their role is? Do you suggest that they talk with the person? Do you suggest that they try in some way to get the university involved in trying to help that student?
You know, at this point, we've not really worked to sort of advertise the existence of the program as much to sort of undergraduate students. We really have a sort of a backbone of about 1,000 people who are in our reporting network, residence hall staff, emergency room personnel, emergency deans, faculty, police, first responders, and we've really asked them to be primarily the data collectors and report writers. And some of that trickles down to individual students, and students will often, you know, will a roommate will go to an RA and say, my roommate, you know, made an attempt or threat, and then that's how we, you know, we receive the report. But we've not really engaged in training of undergraduates directly.
Something that I think is really interesting, and you sort of touch on it later, is the the cry for help idea that I think we have that's part of the conventional wisdom about suicide, and that there is some way in which these people we're talking about, college students, may be a little bit different. And it does have to do, it seems, with with the statement that they are making, or even after there's some attempt at intervention, the way that they will talk about their feeling that that's their business and it's a matter of control over their life, and that they seem to have a tendency to, you know, if someone attempts to intervene, to have a tendency to say, well, it's none of your business. Is that some way in which people of this age group or college students tend to be a little bit different? Or do you, or, again, given the fact that you've said that you're not an expert globally in suicide, is that something that's a characteristic of other people who commit suicide or attempt suicide?
I actually think that would be universal across age groups, that that sense of ownership, that sense of it's my life, that, you know, most of us, we can either be sort of in charge or not in charge of a given domain, and most of us are not really in charge of our continued existence. We sort of defer that to a higher power, to fate, to circumstance, and we live within what remains in terms of sort of choices and options that we have. But someone who's suicidal has actively laid claim to being in charge of whether they live or die, and actually feel a sense of sort of charge or power or identity associated with that in chargeness. In some ways, it's probably most comparable to someone with an eating disorder who sees themselves as sort of in charge of their bodily functions, in a way most of us sort of defer and say, once I've swallowed food, it's on its own. Mm-hmm. Someone with an eating disorder said, well, my stomach is still under my control and I can exercise sort of choices and decisions that other people don't.
Well, and that seems to, in some of those people, that seems to reflect maybe a general feeling of powerlessness. That is, they don't, in a lot of other areas of their lives, they don't have control. So this is at least one place where they can. Does that kind of thinking also operate in people who have this tendency to think about, talk about, attempt suicide?
Well, that's an interesting thought about the sort of almost a displaced need for control, retreating from other areas and emphasizing an area that is theirs alone and can't be interfered with. I'm not so sure clear that that's always the case. I think sometimes there's just sort of an overactive or aggressive sense of being in charge that includes being in charge of one's own life. Mm.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? And someone listening in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to backtrack to your remarks about outreach. Do you contact people? And it seems to me new student orientation, which we are about to undertake, would be a perfect opportunity to give parents information they very much need to have, and it could also be mentioned to the students. And if you do not have a presence at new student orientation, I would like to know why. And if you do, I'd like to know just a little bit about what it is.
You know, at present, I'm not aware that we mention the suicide prevention program at new student orientation.
Why not? You think people, this is a secret? I mean, I think one thing we have learned is it's very important to involve families and parents. And I just, that's why would you not mention it at that, when people are here to get information and to try to help their children adjust into this new situation? Why would you not get this information to them?
Sure, I think that's a reasonable question. I think what we do in each case is we look at where there's an opportunity and a missed opportunity to identify a student who is suicidal and get them into the four sessions of mandated assessment. And I think our tracking data over the last 20 years suggests that we've been highly successful in with undergraduates in terms of identifying who's suicidal and getting them in. Actually, the rate of suicide among undergraduates is our biggest success story. It's down about 80%. Where we've been having trouble is with graduate students, where they're actually committing suicide at a rate 4 to 5 times higher than their undergraduate peers. And we,
well, what do you do at graduate student orientation to make them aware?
Well, that's where I'd like to focus, and that's where our efforts at outreach have been focused, at the higher risk group of graduate students. And we, working with the dean of the graduate college, Richard Wheeler, we sent out 2 different letters to all graduate students and to all graduate faculty, alerting them to this problem and encouraging them to kind of be part of our reporting network, to have kind of peers, be willing in a confidential way to share information of concern about a fellow graduate student. And that actually increased the number of reported incidents among graduate students about 50% subsequent to our efforts.
A real-life person present at any of those orientation sessions, and given the funding requirements of all these programs, I understand you're wanting to be confidential, but I really do question your what seems to be a lot of resistance to having people go to these programs that are set up to give information to just give yourself a little presence.
The Counseling Center does participate in these, these presentations, and they do make the existence of the Counseling Center, right? I think we just don't give, in the limited time available, information about the mandatory suicide assessment program.
Well, I guess I would encourage you to do that because, when it may be improved, but for those that are missed, their life is over. So, I think it's hard maybe to think this as a positive thing, but it really can be if it saves someone's life. And I think it helps to make, for those who are still reluctant about this topic, hearing about it in a non-threatening situation can maybe open their minds a little bit. And our job here is to reach out and give people information.
Well, I appreciate your comments. We're always actively looking at where we can better focus our research, our outreach efforts.
And other questions, comments are welcome, too. Here on the program, the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good to anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana. Also, actually, people who happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you also may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. I'm curious as to why it is that graduate students have a higher risk than undergrads. Is it simply just that the kind of pressures that they face are greater?
I think there are a few reasons. One, I think there is a sheer increase demographically as one gets older. Up until one's 30s and 40s, the rate of suicide itself increases, and so there's sort of a demographic push in that direction. The other is that graduate students are more isolated and live occupational lives that look less like undergraduate students and more like professionals, in which their behavior, particularly sort of mental health related behavior, is going to be part of the mix of evaluations that might occur, and then be less more reluctant to kind of give evidence or show or report to peers or mentors that they've been thinking about suicide or attempted or threatened suicide. And therefore, our program can't intervene if we don't have this sort of advance information that someone's engaged in a suicidal career.
Mm-hmm. So clearly someone who has attempted suicide, there is this requirement that they have this for sessions of mandated counseling. What do you do about that person who seems to talk about it a lot and seems to be at high risk, and people around that person seem to notice that at least, and yet that person doesn't ever follow through and make an attempt? What do you do with someone like that, or is there some way to deal with someone like that?
There are a couple of ways that we might approach that. I think the first way, we do have a sort of an occasional category that does meet the requirement, and that is of significant ideation. If someone is talking about it frequently, though they've not made it a threat, if they talk about it repetitively, and those in the surrounding community say, we're alarmed, we're concerned, and they continue to talk about it, it might cross that threshold of significant ideation, and that might necessitate four times. The other is we look at the impact on the community, and it happens once or twice a year that a student's repeated reference to suicide is disruptive. It's almost like yelling fire in slow motion on a college campus to threaten suicide. And we'll sort of try and work with that student to understand the impact. But with some students, we'll say, because of the impact on other students, we're going to be mandating these same four sessions.
Yeah. Just maybe one other quick point, and that is it seems to me that part of the conventional wisdom about suicide, or one of those things that people think that may not be the case, is that people think individuals who talk about suicide don't do it. And in fact, that's not the case. And that if you have somebody who is talking about suicide, That is something that ought to be taken seriously.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of focus on risk factors, but in that focus on risk factors, we often sort of overlook or underplay the single most important risk factor, and that is somebody either talking about suicide, but particularly threatening or attempting suicide. Mm-hmm. Most studies show that an individual who has attempted suicide is 120 times more likely to die of suicide than someone that hasn't. And on this campus here, we've sort of the data seems to suggest that a college student who has attempted or threatened suicide is 450 times more likely to die in the following year by suicide than another student who hasn't.
Yeah. So that certainly is something that should be taken very, very seriously.
Well, in our program, somewhat a focused approach. We just focus on this one risk factor, but we focus on it pretty rigorously. Yeah.
Let us talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Aurora, up in the northern part of the state here, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. How do you handle this? I have a grandson going to a southwestern state in August to college. I thought he was all excited about it, and I'm sure when you look back, you think, well, it's a new adventure, it's a new thing you're doing. Of course, there's a little apprehension. And so I said to him, I'm sorry to tell you, you're going to a very hot state, and I said, don't be surprised if I don't come down and visit you. I said, I just can't chance that hot weather. And so he said something which I was very surprised. He said something like, yeah, I don't know why I'm going there either. And I was surprised that he said that. So I guess my question is, do you, as a parent, do you discuss this suicide with them before they go to school?
You know, I think that's an individual decision for each parent to make. I certainly think given the statements that your grandson has made, it seems to deserve more kind of comment and dialogue about what he means by that, how he's feeling about going to school, and if it seemed to get closer to issues of suicide or self-harm, then those questions would likely follow.
Oh, so you think that possibly his mom should talk to him about it?
I think what I'm suggesting is that maybe start with talking about his lack of excitement, his reluctance to leave the state and go to this other institution. I think he's made a comment that has a sort of a red flag of concern there. I'm not so sure at this point the concern is necessarily suicidal as much as one of adjustment or homesickness or transition.
Yeah, I think it's a adjustment. I think it is adjustment, and maybe he's saying to himself, gee, I didn't think I'd do a thing like this, but I am. I personally think it's good. He'll learn a lot more about living in life, being away. You know, I'm not saying he shouldn't go. I'm just, you know, I'll suggest it to his mother to talk to him. They have a very, very good relationship. They do. They have a very good relationship. I'll just kind of mention it, you know, that maybe before he leaves, she ought to have some talks with him, and she has had them. And it seems going into it a very, very good situation. I'm very happy for him. And thank you for this kind of talk. It is a necessary discussion to have. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks. Well, thank you. Was there anything else that you wanted to...
Well, I think it's lies a little out of the area of suicide, but I think the transition to college for probably about 10% of students is a pretty severe process, and sometimes we talk about that as homesickness. But I think homesickness sort of under-emphasizes the transitional difficulties that can occur.
Now, certainly, there are all kinds of questions you might suddenly find yourself thinking. Well, have I made the choice of the right place to go to school? Maybe at some point you're thinking about what it is you want to study and what do you want to do for your career? And maybe then you might suddenly think, well, wait a minute, is that the right thing to do. And I'm sure that even going into it, not quite knowing what the experience would be like, there could be a lot of doubts about what's it going to be like? Am I going to be able to cope with the stress? Am I going to be happy? And am I going to meet any friends? Am I going to be successful in college? And I'm sure that there are all kinds of doubts that every, if not every, most students carry with them when they arrive on that first day. Questions and comments again, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're talking this morning about suicide prevention on college campuses. Our guest is Paul Joffe. He's a clinical psychologist. He works at the University of Illinois Counseling Center, and for the past 20 years, he's been chief of the suicide prevention team here at the University of Illinois, which has taken a very proactive approach and adopted this policy. Now, back in the mid-1980s, it requires a student who has attempted suicide to go to 4 mandatory counseling sessions. And in the time that the program has been going, the rate of suicide has been half that of the rate of what it was before the program, and it's also half the rate of the other institutions in the Big Ten. Again, questions are welcome for people who want to get involved. I think I had the opportunity to write to read a paper that you wrote about this a couple of years ago, looking at the whole issue, where you make the observation that a surprisingly small number of colleges have made a significant attempt to deal with the issue, instituting, for example, programs like the one we have here. Maybe let me ask you that as a general question and say, how do you think colleges are doing on a subject like this, suicide prevention, or dealing with students who have attempted suicide?
Well, I think historically colleges have done very little in systematic suicide prevention. I think there's been an assumption that if we have counseling centers, if we have good, robust mental health facilities on college campuses, that's the best sort of preventative barrier to have these resources available. But our data and experience here suggests that you could double or triple the size of your college counseling center and conceivably not lower the rate of suicide at all, given the lack of use of those services by those who are most at risk. In terms of systematic suicide prevention efforts in which you go beyond, you know, your intent and you try and collect evidence, we could say that there may be 5 or 6 studies that are in that ballpark, but really no study prior to our program was either more than a year or two, ours is running now 20 years, and had evidence, statistical evidence, that what they did actually lowered the rate of suicide. So in some ways ours is the first program in the country in an institution of higher education that's a systematic effort that has shown that it's lowered the rate through its efforts. Mm-hmm.
Well, you talked in the earlier part of the interview about the fact that when you started out, what you did was if you had someone who attempted suicide, you made sure that they knew that the counseling center was there and that the resource was there and strongly encouraged them to use it. But that didn't do it. That just saying it's there, it would be a good idea, why don't you come down? And that's why you moved to this other policy that said we're going to require you and that if you don't, it's possible that you might be asked to leave the university. At other places, has there been a hesitance to take such a dramatic step as requiring students who had attempted to go into counseling, to go beyond just saying the help is there if you want it, to saying to them, you must go at least for a certain number of sessions?
You know, I don't have – no one's done a survey recently in terms of the 3,600 colleges and universities, what their current practices are. I think in general, though, college campuses are moving more in our direction, maybe not as far. I think it's probably rare to find that a college campus is not doing anything of a mandated fashion after a suicide attempt or threat. Typically, maybe it's one meeting with a dean, a dean of students, or with a mental health professional. But at least I think 6 schools have adopted our program in the last 2 years, including the University of Washington, Seattle, the University of Puget Sound, in Washington, the University of Oregon is going to start our program in the fall. The University of North Dakota engages in our program. Mm.
So you'll have an opportunity to sort of do some further testing and see how well the same program works other places. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Champaign, line number 1. Hello. Is there a caller there on line 1 in Champaign?
I'm on 4 if you'd like to talk to me.
Oh, well, ma'am, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I would like to know the percentage of girls or boys that commit suicide. And I would like to know, is it usually because they're having falling grades, broken heart, or pregnancy or something like that?
Okay.
The reasons they want to do this.
All right. Well, what can you say about how this breaks down by gender?
First, the good news is that college women commit suicide at a rate about 1/4 for that of college men. And it turns out both for college women and for college men, well, there may be a precipitant, like why now? It's often maybe not the real reason about why at all. And most research shows that that college suicide has very little to do with grades and academics. It can be precipitated by a breakup or a recent event, but by and large, the prevailing reason for someone to be suicidal in the first place has to do with sort of a long-term sort of personality issue or a long-term orientation towards life or a long-term sort of orientation to kind of power and control that's been years in the making. It may, again, be sort of precipitated by a recent event, but I think that in itself often does not explain about why this person committed suicide at all.
Does that get us your question, caller?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that we know is a risk factor for suicide is depression. Do you find that in the students that do attempt and that you have an opportunity to talk to and do some assessment of, that there may have been some issue of depression of some longstanding?
Research shows that about the lifetime risk of committing suicide among someone who is clinically depressed at about 10-15%. But two things are important to keep in mind with that. One, there are about five other categories in which there's about that 10-15% lifetime risk: borderline personality disorder, manic depressive disorder, alcoholism, and schizophrenia. At the same time that maybe 10-15%. Do commit suicide, we also are left with the quandary of what's going on with the 85-90% that have the same disorder that don't commit suicide. Mm-hmm. So there are studies that show that if you backtrack, that 95% of individuals who commit suicide have some form of major mental illness. But on the other hand, other studies that try and predict on the basis of mental illness only find about 20% of those, predicted because of mental illness are result in suicide, and the rest seem to be, not to have mental illness, at least at the time that the prediction was made.
Yeah. Well, you talked about the fact that you have been successful with that there's sort of, broadly speaking, there are two groups. When you look at people who commit suicide, there are two groups. There are those individuals that beforehand have given some indication that there was a problem. Mm-hmm. They've talked about it. They have planned it. They have attempted it. And then there's this other group where you can look at the person's history and background and look for signs, and you'd say, we just don't see anything. There would not have been anything beforehand about that person to make us suspect that he or she was likely to commit suicide. And that's the one that I'm sure that it's very hard to deal with because you don't have any tips that there is a problem. Having said that, though, is there any way that you're trying to address that kind of person, that kind of suicide, where there is no warning, there are no indicators, they just out of the blue, they just do it?
Well, the best that we can tell from sort of research that's been conducted is that it seems like there's an independent personality variable that sort of overlaps with suicidal intent, that not necessarily related to it, but coexists with it, and that there is a kind of a difference in people's personality about their willingness to kind of disclose their intent versus their unwillingness to. And you can see this when we're driving through town, that there are some individuals that give sort of ample indication about when they're going to turn. They use their flashers. You can tell by their car's body language what they're about to do. And others, it's just a complete surprise. And I think the same thing kind of carries over to other areas of people's life, and including suicidal intent. Having said that, what we're working on is that currently what we talk about is out of the blue, is out of the university blue or out of the administrative blue that we didn't know. There have been a couple of instances or a few instances over the years where a friend knew but didn't inform, so it wasn't sort of entirely out of the blue. And we've been working, particularly again with graduate students, to try and expand that range of what blue would you know, the range of which we would know about these situations beforehand.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the fact that the program that you have here now has been going for something like 20 years, and that I believe that it was this particular way of dealing with it, the University of Illinois was the first to have a program like this, and that that there are a small number of schools who have decided that they're going to try it, do it this sort of way. But that there are still a lot of campuses that don't really have a program in place, don't have a kind of policy. And I wonder why that is. I mean, given the fact that one of the things that we know is that on college campuses across the country, student mental health is becoming an increasing issue that they're going to have to confront, and that they've done that by trying to expand the kind of counseling they have and hiring new counselors, and I think a lot of campuses have made a deliberate effort to put more resources in that, knowing that indeed that there was a need. But given that that is the fact, I guess I'm a little bit surprised that there aren't more places that actually have a kind of program like this or similar. Now, maybe the issue is that it just doesn't happen often enough. Maybe that says to you, you know, they think, well, if it only happens to one student a year, or maybe one or two students every 3-4 years, do we need an entire program to deal with a problem like that, or can we even deal with
it? Well, I think part of the larger issue is how we think about suicide and how we hold it in our minds. And I think throughout history, actually, suicide has been something that's been more in the domain of the sacred and the holy, and not in the realm of the scientific. If you go back to the Middle Ages, suicide used to be considered an evil pact with the devil, and the first thing that would happen when someone was suspected of having actually committed suicide is they would hold an inquest or a trial, and if the person was determined to have committed suicide, they would be hung.
If they were already dead,
the corpse would be hung. In France, the body would be dragged through the streets, head down, off the back of a wagon. In England and in parts of New England, there was what was called a crossroads desecration, in which the body would be buried in a busy crossroads with a stake through the body's chest, impaling it to the ground, and a large pile of stones would appear on top. The purpose of this was to defeat the ghosts of those who committed suicide from returning and either harassing the living or inducing the living to pursue similar ends. So again, very much a sense of the sacred and the holy, and the notion of this is an evil person. We need to kind of protect the rest of the community from their influence. That shifted. The last crossroads desecration occurred in England around London about 1826, and about maybe 75 years later, the beginning of a new movement called the Samaritan Movement arose, in which the suicide individual was considered an individual in distress. The distress was the driving element. These were sort of poor souls that needed our support and protection. And that became a kind of a new kind of holiness, in which they were sort of these sort of exalted individuals that needed sort of sanctuary and our protection. And we, in a sense, created a kind of a sacredness around what we perceived to be their distress. Mm-hmm. So I think in that light, what we're doing seems sacrilegious in that vocabulary, that we're kind of violating the sanctuary, that we're adding to their distress, that we're, instead of backing off and giving them sort of freedom and privilege, we're actually making their lives worse, maybe giving them more reason to contemplate suicide. So I think for that reason, because of this sort of sense of sacredness and holy and the offered support and protection, that college campuses are quite reluctant to move in the direction that we have. Hmm.
Is there any liability issue? I mean, is there any concern that if they actually make an attempt to intervene and somehow that goes wrong and it makes things worse, say the person, even after counseling, successfully attempts suicide again, that someone is going to come along and say, well, you actually made things worse.
I think there's been that fear. I think what we're proposing is that what college campuses can do is they can't kind of guarantee the safety of all students, but they can have a standard of care that they apply uniformly and consistently to students who cross this sort of threshold of a threat or an attempt. Mm-hmm. And if they follow that standard of care, despite what the outcome, that they might be protected from liability at that point.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have someone listening in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I have not been able to follow your conversation very closely, but I had a couple of thoughts about the subject and wondered how you would respond. The undergrad years, especially of college, I think are an extraordinarily vulnerable time for a lot of young people, and they're confronted often for the first time with an enormous number of very brilliant people. And though it can be stimulating, it can also daunt them and make them realize their deficiencies in a very painful, difficult way. And I think that makes them particularly subject to feelings of hopelessness at that age. And coupled with that, it's interesting to me that in primary and secondary education, teachers get a great deal of counseling, coursework, et cetera, about how to deal with their students in an empathetic and caring way. And college teachers are people that are in love with their subject and are wonderful presenting the subject, but are often curiously not clued in to their students. And I've known, regrettably, far too many college profs whose seemingly their singular goal is to be brilliant, and often at the expense of the student. And this can impact students in a, you know, a profound, very huge, sudden way, or in very, very subtle ways through those years, to give messages of their own inadequacy and hopelessness. And it's sort of like an experience going to the doctor where the doctor really doesn't care, where one has that feeling. And being in a class of someone who's, you know, just a giant of a person, and yet one has a sense that they don't care and one could never measure up. And I'm a college prof myself, and I see colleagues who behave in extraordinarily insensitive ways toward their students at times. So, those are my comments.
I think those are just wonderful observations about the college environment, particularly in the academic portion of things, that you know, create a great deal of stress. I think. On the other side, though, that there are a lot of compensatory experiences in terms of the residence hall staff and the caring that occurs, you know, among the RAs. I think there are a number of different sort of environments and settings that help sort of compensate for that and create a kind of a cushion or create the support that...
Absolutely, there is. But certain individuals can really get, I think, a little bit crushed in that environment, and perhaps the RA's opinions or even counselors' opinions may not matter quite as much as the primary professor's opinions or what they presume to be their opinions.
No, I agree. It is a very stressful environment for some.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what I had to say.
All right. Well,
thank you for your
thanks
show.
For the call. And if someone wanted to call real quick, we could probably get in one more caller. Otherwise, we'd have a couple of more minutes here with our guest, Dr. Paul Jaffe. He's a clinical psychologist. He works at the U of I Counseling Center. And for the last 20 years, he's been the chair of the suicide prevention team here at University of Illinois. Generally speaking, do you think, as a result of a kind of a specific focus on college students, does that add anything to our greater understanding of suicide, and can we apply that at all to the idea of suicide prevention, not just for college students, but for anyone?
I think there's a tendency within the field of suicide to get sort of fascinated with the subject of the individual who is suicidal. I mean, it presents such a kind of a fascinating kind of tapestry of what led them to that point. But I think particularly in the area of suicide prevention, that the primary focus actually needs not to be the suicide individual, but the community, because it's always the community. I mean, we kind of forget that this person just made the decision to end their own life, and then we turn around and sort of attribute all kinds of qualities to them, like they're going to be great at help seeking, they're going to be sort of together, So it seems to me if we sort of follow with that assumption that someone who particularly as a young adult who felt it necessary to end their life, that there may be some problem in sort of issues of self-determination or decision making. You know, suicide to cry for help is a little bit kind of like wishful thinking. It'd be great if that's what what it was, but really it's much more complicated than it. It is someone with a disorder of power and control, and then the burden falls on the community to set into motion these sort of programs to both detect someone who's suicidal and then to kind of intervene in an active way as we have.
Is there any, this is probably asking a question without really having enough time to deal with it very effectively, but when you get in a counseling situation with someone like this, a student has attempted suicide and they're in their mandated sessions of counseling, how you approach that? Or is there any generality and you just have to say, well, every individual is different, so you approach a situation differently?
Well, I mean, there are layers that occur, but one layer is that we first acknowledge that a report has been made. We ask them to share us what happened, to comment on its accuracy, just sort of square away. We sort of kind of again outline that this is a mandated set of appointments. But one thing that we do want to get across is that the university does have a standard of self-welfare, that just as students are expected to carry themselves without being kind of violent or disruptive to other individuals and to maintain grade point average, that there's also the standard that we expect them to kind of take care of their own lives and their own physical existence, and if they run into kind of a problem, that they seek appropriate help, that it's not a privilege to be self-violent. We have a zero-tolerance policy on violence, and that includes violence towards others, but also violence towards yourself. Mm-hmm. So we have a community expectation that I think is different, where before I think it was more like encouraging people to live. Now we're kind of saying, well, you know, we expect you to, you know, to adhere to the standard of self-welfare.
And for any student that's having problems and is seeking some counseling, some help, some assistance, no matter what it is, all they have to do is either go to the counseling center or pick up the phone and call.
Yeah, and the number is 333-3701.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it for this hour of focus. Our guest again, Paul Jaffe, clinical psychologist. He's on the staff at the U of I Counseling Center and is the chair of the suicide prevention team here at University of Illinois. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Coming up a little bit later today, as part of the afternoon magazine, historian Douglas Flaming will be talking with the host, Celeste Quinn. The theme of his most recent book, Bound for Freedom, is civil rights as a way of life. His book tells the story of black Americans leaving the South in search of freedom and liberty in Los Angeles in the first half of the 20th century. He says they fought to gain their rights and to protect them. That'll be the topic of conversation in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon, with the usual mix of news and sports and weather and features. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Coming up in the next part of this show, we will be talking about the long-running battle between conventional and alternative medicine. And our guest for the program will be Natalie Robbins. She's written a new book, which is titled Copeland's Cure. The book profiles Royal Copeland. He was an eye surgeon who worked to establish homeopathy as a legitimate practice. So we'll talk more about that in the next part of Focus 580. As we usually do this time, we'll take a break. We have news from NPR at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the markets. So please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.